Some of the nation's leading universities have been testing out the theory that a college might run better if it acted more like a business. Various schools, public and private, have reorganized, altered their management styles, formed alliances with corporations, and for better or worse, those changes have affected the education available to millions. The writer and college professor David L. Kerp has traced this trend in a book called Shakespeare, Einstein, and the Bottom Line. He's in our studios here in Washington, and welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what is really different about universities in general than they were 20 years ago?
Like, the biggest difference isn't the need for money. Universities have needed money forever. If that weren't the case, the idea of legacy wouldn't have a college-specific meaning. But the amount of money needed has grown enormously because of big science and other huge demands, and the drive for prestige, even as traditional sources of money, particularly state dollars, have dried up.
People like to talk about ivory towers and institutions that are separate from the business world, but you write about a world where corporate buzzwords and buzz phrases are very prevalent.
I don't want to romanticize what academe used to be like. There's always been this money concern, but now the language of money, the ethic of money, the idea of money, markets, competition, total quality management, responsibility center management, and on and on and on, have all gotten imported not just because they're necessary, not just because schools need to raise money, but because they're thought to represent the good. And sometimes I think it's a good thing. Sometimes the market wakes up tired institutions. Sometimes competition makes an institution really figure out what it's about other than its own convenience. The danger to me, the good and bad parts of the market arise when universities forget what they're about.
What's a university that forgot what it was about?
Well, maybe the best example I can think of, there are two good examples. One is the Darden School of Business and the University of Virginia. Darden was in a tough place. As part of a state university, if the business school was going to compete nationally, then it was going to have to figure out a way to raise money on its own. Darden built a Taj Mahal to house, feed, and educate senior executives from around the country and around the world who would pay tons of money to be educated by professors at the university. And those professors basically were bought out of their regular teaching obligations to teach tailor-made courses to these executives.
Made a bunch of money for the university.
Made a bunch of money for Darden. And for them, the rationale is simple. We've got to do this if we're going to compete with Harvard and Stanford and the like.
Well, are they competing with Harvard?
Well, they are, and they're doing. They are certainly competing with them in the employer satisfaction rankings, and they're bringing in large chunks of money. What it's not so good at, given its reputation, is doing the kinds of things that you'd like an academic institution to spend some time on, and that is thinking new ideas about business.
So the Darden Business School at the University of Virginia has changed. What's the other one that came to your mind as having?
The other one was the University of Southern California. And the University of California, Southern California story has a happy ending. But for a long stretch of time, it made the mistake of trying to run itself, the institution, as if it were a business, with profit and loss centers and a notion that every unit on the campus, the law school, the music department, the liberal arts college, basically treated as revenue, the tuition it brought in.
The different schools, the different parts of the university were like the different parts of a multinational corporation.
Exactly. They're really like, they're like any firm, right? The firm says, okay, we make widgets and we also make tires and we also, you know, grow bananas. And each of these units has got to stand on its own hind legs.
The more students you got to your particular part of the university, the more tuition that part of the university would collect, the greater the profits, and so they would do anything to get students to enroll in their part as opposed to the other school across campus.
Exactly. I mean, one nice example is the fact that all students at USC, as at many schools, had to satisfy a general education requirement. Well, historically, the liberal arts college had offered the general education courses.
General education courses like?
They were classically English and history and physics and biology, but all of a sudden, introduction in real estate, the real estate school claimed, ought to be, that's a general education course. And so you had the theater department actually putting ads in the newspaper saying, want to kill off your English lit requirement without having to do any reading? Sit back, watch Shakespeare perform, eat your popcorn, get your credits.
And that'll count as a basic requirement.
And that'll count, and you'll get tons of students. You get hundreds and hundreds of students. You can sort of do the tuition calculation, and now the department becomes rich.
There's also this tremendous competition among universities for prestige and for the best students. How has that affected the university landscape?
Well, the big factor in the last generation in powering that competition has been the rise to dominance of the U.S. News and World Report ranking system. Everybody knows about this system.
This is a weekly news magazine. They do this annual.
This is a weekly news magazine, and students treat this and families treat this as a kind of Bible. And this means that schools go to extraordinary, perverse lengths to look good in that ranking system. Schools such as Duke said to students who had no chance of getting admitted, apply to our school. Please apply to our school. Why? Because selectivity is a really, really important factor in the U.S. news rankings. So the more students they could reject, the better their rankings looked. So they were inviting applications from students they knew had no chance of getting admitted.
There are a lot of parents who have just in the last few months finished with their kids going through this process of early admissions for colleges. How has that been affected by this competition?
Well, that's another wonderful example. Early admission has mushroomed as a phenomenon in the last 10 years, and there are schools that admit up to half their students by early decision. It's a lot easier to be admitted by early decision. It's worth about 100 points in the SAT test to apply early decision as opposed to regularly. Because, again, the selectivity factor of the U.S. News and World Report is your explanation. Almost everybody who's admitted on early decision comes to your school. So you're getting 100% of the students who you want wanting you. That makes you look good.
That's because that's the other side of selectivity.
Exactly.
If you accept students and then they go somewhere else, it looks bad for you.
Exactly. It's also the case that your financial aid reward is going to be a lot smaller if you're admitted on early decision than if you're admitted through normal admissions. Why? Because you're now a captive customer. You've agreed to go to that school, and then the school can basically decide it doesn't have to woo you with money.
Tell me if I'm overstating the case here as you see it, Mr. Kerp. You're saying that thousands and thousands of families just finished getting their kids through this early admissions process. They're very proud that they got into some private university or worked very hard to get into a university. And you're saying, number one, they kind of skated on the standards to get them in there in the first place, and number two, they're probably getting shafted on their tuition.
Well, I'm saying that, and I'm saying something maybe a little broader in terms of its social significance. The only parents who can play this game are wealthy parents. Because if you're a poor parent, you can't make a college decision without knowing what kind of financial aid is available to you. So you can apply early decision because you don't know at that point how much money you're going to be receiving. Whereas if what you care most about is getting your child into a school and you can foot the bill, then it's not a bad trade-off to
go
make.
Do and the so, early admission and get them in there.
And so what's increasingly happening is that wealthier kids are going to the most prestigious schools and poorer kids are going farther and farther down the line. There's a statement by the chief lobbyist for the major higher education organization, which I don't think exaggerates the case, that dumb rich kids get into college at about the same rate as smart poor kids. And that's getting worse. And one of the reasons for this is this drive to compete.
We've been talking to David L. Kerp. He's a professor at the University of California at Berkeley and the author of Shakespeare, Einstein, and the Bottom Line. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks a lot for having me.